From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. It's no secret our political world is polarized. One Duke University ethics professor thinks we can fight the polarization through arguments. You'll learn how. Even before Hurricane Florence swept through North Carolina, state lawmakers were talking about improving disaster relief. You'll hear one idea that involves learning lessons from farmers. A Wake Forest University expert places North Carolina's proposed state constitutional amendments in a national context. How do we compare with other states? You'll learn. And we'll delve into the history of state restrictions on medical facilities and major equipment. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Over the past few years, we've seen example after example of college campus protesters seeking to shut down the speech of those with whom they disagree. Things like that have even happened here in North Carolina. A new report from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, along with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE as it's known, analyzes the status of free speech on North Carolina campuses. Jenna Robinson is president of the Martin Center. She joins us now. Jenna, it's been a while since we've talked with you. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here, Donna.
This is not the first time that you have been involved in this type of report.
Right.
This goes back 7 or 8 years, I believe.
Right. We did our first report also with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education in 2010, looking at the majority of colleges and or universities, rather, in North Carolina to see how they rated on free speech. And now we're just revisiting that same question. What kind of progress has been made in the last 8 years?
As we get into that, give us a sense first of your analysis from the 2010 era. How would you describe the state?
In the 2010 report, it was very disappointing is how I would describe it. There were no green light schools in the state. Green light, of course, meaning free of speech restrictions. So there were no schools at which students and faculty could expect, you know, real free speech as guaranteed by the First Amendment. And so that was the most disappointing thing in 2010. But we also found a lot of schools, a very significant number of schools, where there were substantial free speech policies that regulated free speech that made it hard for students to even, you know, hand out a constitution or
And you're not joking
people.
About that.
No,
that's
I am
actually
not
happened.
Joking about that. That is right. That's a real case. Or restrictions on where students could canvas just to get members for their student organizations. So there were very, very real restrictions in 2010. And so overall, I would say that the 2010 report was a wake-up call for us and I think for others in North Carolina about how bad it really was.
And I know in the ensuing years after that report was released, your organization talked a lot about how this was an issue in North Carolina, and you did a lot of outreach to try to make sure that chancellors, faculty members, students understood what was actually occurring on those campuses. So let's fast forward to the new report. Have we made any progress?
Absolutely. North Carolina is now the nation's leader in protecting free speech on campus. So this is a huge turnaround from 2010. We now have 8 schools in North Carolina with green lights, which is wonderful. 7 of those 8 schools are in our public university system. The only private school on that list is Duke University. And that is a huge improvement. And a lot of schools have gone from red lights to yellow lights, which is some marginal improvement. And I know that with some of these policies, it does get difficult to write them in such a way that you can get to that green light. And so I know that there are schools right now that are still working on changing their policies to get to green light. They do have that goal in mind. So we're in a much better place in North Carolina. We're leading the nation, and I expect to see more progress in the future.
Are there one or two universities in the state that really are perhaps head and shoulders above others?
I hate to do this because I went to NC State, but UNC Chapel Hill is really the leader on
gotcha.
This issue.
Right.
And NC State is lagging behind. But UNC Chapel Hill was the first state in – or the first university in our state to get a green light rating from FIRE. They were also the second school – in North Carolina to adopt the Chicago principles. And the Chicago principles are a statement saying that they value free speech. They value open inquiry on campus. So it's more than just removing the policies that restrict free speech. It's actually making a commitment to the value of free speech and why it's so important on campus. And so UNC Chapel Hill really is, I think, the one to emulate on this issue.
Jenna, when we talk about free speech on campuses, and I mentioned protesters a few minutes ago, people might have in their mind's eye, well, it's just, you know, protesting and kids will be kids, et cetera. That's what the college experience is all mm-hmm. about. But actually, you look at all sorts of different policies that people
right.
may not even realize exist on a college campus. Let's talk a little bit more about that. For example, harassment policies. What is that all about?
Right. So all of the policies that it's actually – so FIRE does the legal work on this. I have to give them all the credit for doing the legal work. And so they know which policies to look at. So harassment policies obviously have a place on campus. You should not be able to assault people, to stalk people. All of those things are, you know, there are legitimate reasons for having those kinds of policies. But many of our universities have gone way too far to the point that they have harassment policies in place where if anyone finds, you know, a joke slightly off color, then that can be considered harassment. If someone overhears something that was not even directed at them, that can be considered harassment. And I think the biggest problem with it is that some of these policies make the standard for what constitutes harassment entirely subjective. So students and faculty do not know what to expect. And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, harassment is on that list, because it often bleeds into it's just conversation. It's just speech that universities have reclassified to consider harassment. And so that's why you see something like that on the list.
And taking that issue one step further, there are policies in place that have to do with what's called hate speech. First of all, what is hate speech?
So hate speech legally doesn't have a meaning. All speech in the United States under our First Amendment is treated in the same way with very, very few restrictions. And so hate speech, according to the people who are proponents of using hate speech as a tool to, you know, to shut down speech on campus, would say that it's something that if someone finds offensive, normally directed at a protected class of people because of their gender, because of their race, because of their country of origin. But legally, as I said, even really offensive, ugly speech is protected.
Jenna, there's also policies on campuses about where you can do certain things. You mentioned a few minutes ago that the case where someone was passing out literally copies of the Constitution and was told that they were not allowed to do
right,
that.
Right, absolutely. So a lot of universities have what are called free speech zones, which means that most of the campus is not open to free speech. And they have carved out a little special section where you are allowed to have free speech. One of the most egregious examples was at UNC Greensboro. They have cleaned up their policy. They don't do this anymore. But it's still – it's so – such a good illustration that I like to still tell it. Their zone for free speech was near a bus stop by the highway. So it wasn't welcoming for students. It wasn't in the quad. It wasn't in the center of campus where students would actually be able to communicate with their peers. It was really this tiny little free speech, ghetto almost, where you know, this is where we put the people who want to speak their minds. We're hiding them away. So it was terrible.
Jenna, we've made a lot of progress, as you noted, but going forward, there are still a number of North Carolina campuses that are red lights and yellow lights, not the green lights that you would want to see. What is the biggest area of concern for you that you would hope to see some reforms going forward?
I would like to see our UNC system campuses, the ones that have not cleaned up their policies, I'd like to see them take action first. And they really are, under the new law here in North Carolina, supposed to do that. And honestly, I expect that they will over the next year. I think we'll see more progress.
We've been talking with Jenna Robinson. She is the president of the Martin Center. Jenna, thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats, Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's no secret that we live in a politically polarized society. Is there any way to help reduce polarization? Duke ethics professor Walter Sinnott Armstrong thinks so. He's written a book titled Think Again. It contends that reason and argument can help us deal with our problems. During a recent speech in Raleigh, Sinnott Armstrong first touched on other ideas for tackling our polarized world.
What is the solution? Well, there's some solutions that don't work. I am a child of the 60s. I admit it. I love the Beatles. But all you need is love. Yeah, great. Okay. So that's not going to work, because how do you get everybody to love each other? You haven't told me how to bring that about. It's an ideal, but, you know, I'm spending all this time in bed, Yoko Ono and John Lennon, they thought that would do it, but it didn't work. And so I don't know how you make that happen. Well, let's reform politics. Let's get rid of gerrymandering. How are you going to do that? And why do you think that's going to be enough? Because even the Senate is polarized, and it has nothing to do with gerrymandering, right? And so I think... It's hard to see how you're going to do it. Some people want to focus on doing it in politics. I think it's great. You want to focus at all the different levels at once. How about avoid the internet? Avoid cable news? Yeah, right. You do it. Other people aren't going to do it. It's not going to make any difference, right? It's not really going to change anything. You're not going to be infected by it, but you're still going to be living in the same world. So what we need is practical steps that each of us as practical individuals can do to reduce this problem, not solve it, not get rid of it, but reduce it in our everyday lives.
If those options don't work, what will? Sinnott Armstrong points to a local example from Durham history.
C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater were enemies. I mean, literally, you know, he would bring a gun when he met with her because he was worried. C.P. Ellis was the head of the local Ku Klux Klan. And Ann Atwater was the head of the local protest movement and was fighting for civil rights for African Americans in Durham, especially housing. But some brilliant politician turned to them and said, I want you to co-chair the committee that's going to integrate the Durham public schools. And by the way, if you decline, then the other person's going to be the sole chair of that committee. So they were stuck. I mean, they were like getting pressured into this. You don't want that to happen. So they got to work together. And I think Ann Atwater was the first one who started it. She turned to him and said, okay, look, if we're going to work together, I want to get to know you. Tell me, like, you know, so what do you got against integrating the schools? And he said, well, I think if we integrate the schools, it's going to lower the quality. And I want my kids to get a good education. And she said, well, I want your kids to get a good education too, and I want my kids to get a good education. He said, I think it's fine if you, I want your kids to get it. Turns out they both just wanted to get their kids a good education. They had different views, very different views, about how to bring that about. But once they recognized they had a common goal, right, and that they shared that value of helping the kids be better in the next generation, then they were able to work together, and they succeeded in working together and were friends for the rest of their lives.
What lesson does Senate Armstrong learn from this Durham story?
I admit it's rare, but it shows that even extreme polarization can be overcome if you do what? What was the key there? The key was she asked the question, not just what do you think about integration, but why? What's the reason that's going to reveal the value behind what you're doing?
Senator Armstrong says people should ask more questions and answer them, even when they don't have a great answer.
A lot of the time, the answer is, I don't know. And we have to get used to admitting that and saying to the other person, I don't know. What do you think? And then listening to them. And if they don't know, you go, oh, I've got this little tool here called the internet, then I can look it up. But which websites are we going to trust? Oh, which one do you recommend? Which one do I recommend? Let's check it out, right? And do some exploration. Notice one thing we don't have is enough time to do that, right? It's really problematic. One reason that I agree with you, most of these political issues, I don't know exactly what to think about them. I've got some range of answers. You know, I don't think, you know, we should have no immigrants in our country, and I don't think we should just let everybody in. But we're in the middle. I don't know. That's really complex, and I don't know enough about the data. Do I have time to check out that issue? No. So you have to do some exploration, but you can't do it on everything. So you got to pick the ones you're going to work on and figure out, and then what you believe on those, and then admit. People have to get used to admitting that they don't know. That's the solution, I think. It's another cultural change.
That's ethics professor Walter Sinnott Armstrong of Duke University. He spoke recently at Raleigh about his book, Think Again, How to Reason and Argue. Sinnott Armstrong says the best questions will lead to answers in the form of arguments.
If you ask the most important questions, I want to say are, why do you believe that? Why did that happen? How is that going to work? All those kinds of questions, the answers are in effect arguments. What are arguments? Most people misunderstand arguments. They think, you know, mommy and daddy are arguing tonight. Well, no, and they're fighting. They're not arguing. You can't argue by throwing a pan. That is not a premise. And they're also not debates. It's also not theater. I'm not just like showing off how smart I am. That's not the point of arguing either. But they're not debates. My favorite point about debates is suppose we have a debate we disagree. I give an argument, you give an argument, and I go, you're right. I'm convinced you're absolutely right. Who won? And the answer is, he didn't win anything. He ended up exactly where he started. I won because I gained something. I learned something. We have to start thinking of arguments as means of communicating with each other and understanding each other and each other's reasons. Then we'll see that the winner of the argument is the one who's convinced because they learned something. That's a very different view of argument that I think is much more constructive.
Senator Armstrong offers his definition of argument.
An argument's a connected series of statements intended to establish, or I would say give a reason for, a conclusion. So it's an intellectual process. It's not just yelling or automatically denying or anything like that. Arguments then present reasons, and there are different kinds of reasons. I've said this before. It's reasons to believe. There are reasons why things happen. There are reasons to act. This is why you should do it. There are reasons to doubt, which are not reasons to believe anything, but to wonder what is true and to realize that you need to think more about it. Reasons come in many different kinds. What we need to understand is that these reasons serve a number of different purposes. One is that you actually show respect for somebody when you ask them a question why. These days, I think if you ask, well, why do you believe that? And people go, that's offensive. How dare you demand me give a, you know, like, whoa, no, no. Notice I never ask my dog for reasons. I only ask people for reasons when I think they're capable of giving reasons and I can learn something from them. It's a sign of respect to ask you for reasons and to give you reasons. I don't give my dog reasons either. I just pull the leash, like, come this way. And so I don't do that with my wife, which is why we've been married for 42 years. Or I'm not sure that's why, but anyway, you show respect for each other. You, learning your reasons helps me understand you. I don't just understand what you believe, but I understand why you believe it. And that's a deeper kind of understanding, which helps me respect you.
That's Duke ethics professor Walter Sinnott Armstrong. He's explaining why he believes reasoned argument can help address the problem of political polarization. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E, .org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are focusing on improving disaster relief linked to Hurricane Matthew. Some want to see better planning for the next disaster. That includes Republican Representative Jimmy Dixon.
The number one problem is that I think we've lulled ourselves into complacency, and we've allowed the public to think that any time a disaster occurs, it's the government's responsibility to get us out of the disaster. I think individual responsibility comes first. I think choosing where I build my home, choosing where I build my business is very important. And if I make bad choices, I don't think I need to depend on the rest of the taxpayers to bail me out. Now, having said that, we understand that it doesn't always work that way. If we don't get this right, if we don't make this initial move, then we need a whipping and be sent to time out.
Dixon suggests government planners could learn some lessons from North Carolina's farmers.
We have to get ready to plant a crop every year. Weather conditions are different. But we have a plan for how we prepare our fields. That plan might change if it's too wet or if it's too dry. We know that these things are going to come. To be sure, we can develop a plan of action that will be adaptable to anything that occurs. And here's our plan. And we've already got it ready for the federal government. This is what we're going to do. That step right there. If we can't at least incrementally begin to develop these kinds of steps, then, we're going to be dealing with these kind of things forever. And so my question is this. What, if anything, is being done about this fourth step here where it says action plan development? What are you doing, if anything, to develop an action plan that will be applicable to the next disaster?
Dixon cautioned against changing government rules to help those who know how to game the system. He doesn't want to see more waste or misuse of funds.
I don't think any of us in here want or are looking to make these money easy for folks to get, because we know that there are people out there doing every one of these kinds of things who have become expert in harvesting disaster money to supplement other things. So we're not talking about making it easier. We're talking about making it more efficient so that we can identify those who truly need it and be able to deliver the funds to them more efficiently.
That's State Representative Jimmy Dixon. He's sharing his concerns about disaster relief in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina voters have had frequent chances to amend the state constitution over the years. Why? Our next guest offers an expert opinion. Dr. John Dinan is professor of politics and international affairs at Wake Forest University. He's also author of the book, State Constitutional Politics, Governing by Amendment in the American States. Welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
So people who have been in North Carolina for a while probably remember that, every couple of years or so, it seems like we do something to consider amending the state constitution. Is that common across the country?
Yeah. First of all, North Carolina, its 1971 constitution has been amended 36 times. So that's almost four decades. That's almost one amendment per year, about a little under that. That is relatively in the broad middle of the pack when we come to the states. Virginia, our neighbor, they're right about one amendment average per year. Now, you don't always see one amendment per year, but we're doing the averages. There are some states that are well above that average. Alabama, on average, amends its state constitution 8 times a year. Louisiana, 4 times a year. And then you've got on the other end of the spectrum, Vermont, which amends its constitution on average only once every 4 years. So the best way I'd put it is there's broad variation among the states in this matter, as in so many others. And North Carolina is well in the middle of the pack in terms of about an average rate of amendment. Of course, it should be said that that is well higher than the U.S. constitutional rate of amendment. But all the states amend their constitution more frequently than the U.S. Constitution.
among the states that do amend the Constitution fairly regularly, what kinds of things typically get put into the document?
Yeah. I mean, one way of thinking about this is what are some of the amendments that we might see on this year, how around the country, how do these compare? One of the type of amendments are you see a lot of amendments dealing with whether legislatures can borrow money. A lot of states have written in their constitutions limits on how money can be borrowed. They're afraid of if you just leave it to the legislature, they'll borrow too much money, and that's been happening in the past. And so they say, well, you can only borrow so much money, or you can only borrow money if you let the people approve that borrowing. And so when legislatures want to borrow more money than the Constitution allows, sometimes they put on the ballot constitutional amendments saying, well, could you allow us to borrow in these kinds of cases? Could you allow us to do these kind of things? That's actually been one of the more frequent North Carolina amendments, and that's very common around the country. A lot of amendments dealing with financing, budgeting. About three dozen states have state constitutional amendments requiring a balanced budget. North Carolina is one of those. In 1977, North Carolina amended its state constitution to say the budget must be balanced. Of course, there's no federal balanced budget amendment. Turns out that Indiana this year is bidding to become the 37th state to add a balanced budget amendment to its state constitution. There's a lot more that could be said, but a lot of these amendments deal with financing, budgeting, taxes, and spending.
That is the voice of Professor John Dinan of Wake Forest University, author of the book State Constitutional Politics, Governing by Amendment in the American States. The amendment in North Carolina that's attracted the most attention during the course of this year has dealt with voter identification. Yeah, yeah. Is that the type of thing other states have dealt with by amendment as well?
First of all, it's important to note what would this amendment accomplish if it were approved, and what wouldn't it accomplish? The main purpose of a voter ID amendment in the North Carolina Constitution would to insulate a state voter ID requirement from state court reversal. People might recall back in 2016, the original North Carolina voter ID law was subject to federal court challenge and state court challenge. And the state court challenge was you can't add another requirement to voting in the state constitution. In fact, some of the people bring the challenges, you would have to amend the state constitution to add that in. And so the purpose of a voter ID amendment would be to prevent a North Carolina state Supreme Court from invalidating a voter ID law. I emphasize that because it says nothing about what a federal court might do to a North Carolina voter ID amendment. Federal judges don't care at all about whether voter ID is in a statute or in a constitutional amendment. Now, how common is this? Turns out Arkansas will also be voting on a very similar voter ID amendment this November. Missouri voted on a voter ID amendment just 2 years ago. So if North Carolina and both those states, it was approved. And the idea in both of those cases was state courts had struck down those state voter ID laws on state constitutional grounds. And so the legislature came back and said, let's resolve this through a constitutional amendment and let's make it very clear the state constitution does not forbid a state from adopting voter ID.
One of the things that's also cropped up that might surprise people is a constitutional amendment that would protect the right to hunt and fish. This is not something that's unique to North Carolina, is it?
Not at all. In the last two decades, 20 states have amended their state constitutions to protect the right to hunt and fish. Now, these are phrased in different ways. Sometimes these are policy grounds. Oh, hunting and fishing should be preserved. But sometimes those are phrased as in a constitutional right. Individuals have a right to hunt and fish. What those are really directed towards is the Humane Society groups and other conservation groups have proposed certain regulations, and the idea is that this putting this in the state constitution would make it tougher for some of these regulations on trapping or fishing to be adopted. If North Carolina put that on its ballot this year, it would become the 22nd state to have a right to hunt and fish. Other amendments under consideration in North Carolina around the country would be to tighten existing victims' rights provisions. Another five states will be voting on victims' rights amendments. There's no victims' rights amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but 35 states have said we want to protect this. North Carolina has already adopted a victims' rights amendment back in 1996, but now North Carolina and other states are considering, let's tighten that up and provide additional specific guarantees beyond what we've already done.
We've talked about borrowing, finances, election-related amendments, things to do with crime victims' rights. Are there any amendments in recent memory dealing with things such as property rights?
Yes, very much so. First of all, 49 states have in their state constitution explicit protection against eminent domain takings. That's where a government comes in and says, your land would be very valuable for something else. We're going to take your land. We'll pay you money, what it's worth. 49 states the 50th state is North Carolina, which is, does not have an explicit protection. Courts have reached such protections through implication, but North Carolina stands alone in not having that. But a number of states have gone further. They responded to U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2005 where people asked the U.S. Supreme Court, can you actually protect us against eminent domain takings when someone's going to build a shopping mall and then kind of take my land? It's one thing to build an airport or a road, but a shopping mall? And the U.S. Supreme Court said by 5-4 decision, nope, the federal constitution doesn't provide you that protection. A dozen states in the last decade have said, we want to provide that protection through our state constitutional amendment, and they've done so. North Carolina could consider adopting an amendment of that kind, and if they did so, it would be well in keeping with other states around the country.
Has your research given you a sense of how seriously the people who get to vote on these take this amendment of the Constitution? If, I mean, if there are lots of constitutional amendments, do people just say, oh, this is another thing I'm voting for? Or do they tend to take this very seriously?
What we found is in some states you can have a lot of amendments on the ballot. It's not unusual in Texas or Louisiana to have 9 or 10 constitutional amendments on the ballot in a given year, or in California or Colorado and Arizona. Other states are more. You might see 1 or 2. What you find, though, is that people don't have a broad knowledge of all 9 or 10 of those, but they pick up cues from newspapers, from interest groups, from think tanks that they trust, and they look to them for cues. Every once in a while, you see a voter decision. You say, oh, that's a curious decision. But for the most part, you see people that seem to be making rational decisions and voting in their interest and not clearly against their interest.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting topic, not only in North Carolina, but across the country. And one person who will follow as this state moves forward on constitutional amendments is Dr. John Dinan, professor of politics and international affairs at Wake Forest University, also author of the book, State Constitutional Politics, Governing by Amendment in the American States. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Expanded access to doctors and hospitals at a lower cost. Now, that is the goal that most folks can agree on, regardless of ideology, when it comes to reforming our healthcare system. Our next guest says that a good first step toward meeting that goal is to take a very serious look at a North Carolina law that works against the expansion of options and against bringing down costs. Jordan Roberts is the new healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now. Jordan, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In a nutshell, explain to us what we're talking about here. This law is technically called Certificate of Need, but what does it do? What's it require?
That's right. So Certificate of Need laws were put in place a couple decades ago in an attempt to lower healthcare costs by limiting the supply of healthcare services that are provided. So what ends up happening is if you are a physician that wants to provide a new service or a existing facility that wants to expand, you would need to go to a state planning board and prove to them that there is a need to provide this service at levels higher than what is already being provided. You'd submit an application, and the state would look at their data to see if they project a similar need, and then they would either grant access or deny access. So what ends up happening is you have government bureaucrats that are really deciding who can enter into the healthcare market, and that really has some adverse effect for a lot of consumers and providers.
What you found in your research, Jordan, and it's really interesting because you've been writing about this, and folks can read your blog in the locker room at johnlock.org. You found that North Carolina was by far not the first state to do this, and certainly
That's right.
Has been going on for decades and decades and decades. Tell us about the history of con laws.
So what I found was that these certificate of need laws really came about in the as far back as the 1800s, and they were used to regulate businesses and industries like the railroads, public utilities, things like this. And they were implemented to try to reduce wasteful duplication of services back then and what people referred to as ruinous or bad competition. So to take the railroads, for example, what would happen is there were laws in place that would restrict the railroads from charging market rates to their customers. And so in an attempt to keep the railroad companies that were already in existence profitable, the state would use certificate of need laws in an attempt to insulate those current railroad providers from any type of competition. So from the earliest onset, it was really an example of cronyism. And so there was a lot of progressive ideas during the 1800s at this time. And so it wasn't uncommon for these state legislatures to try to regulate business to this extent.
Now, when you fast forward into the 1900s, then North Carolina, among a number of states that still have certificate of need laws in place. And I think, Jordan, when people listening to us might be thinking, you know what, it kind of sounds like the motives of the people who support this kind of thing might be good. They're trying to, quote, protect people from high prices, et cetera. But as you mentioned earlier, there's really a lot of negative consequences that come with this that people may not realize. Let's talk about some of those that you've been writing about. You're talking about reducing the access to health care. How does a con law do that?
So by limiting the amount of competition that you can – or that a incumbent hospital provider can have, it really just limits the number of choices that patients have to go and get care. So what we see is that states that have certificate of need laws, they have much fewer rural health care, rural hospitals and other health care substitutes like this in these types of counties. And the patients that are in states with certificate of need laws have to travel much further to get the same types of procedures done that other similar citizens would have to travel in states without certificate of need laws. And there's also, you know, the thought that this really raises costs. So a lot of the procedures that can be done in hospitals that are protected by certificate of need laws from any type of competitors charge a lot more for, let's say, an ACL surgery. And so if you were to get this ACL surgery done in a state without a certificate of need law, you might have a lot more options to get it at a lot lower cost facilities. So these laws, really what they do is they protect incumbent providers by not allowing any competitors to come into the market and charge lower rates for patients.
You know, that's a really important point, because a few minutes ago when you described what the original intent of a con law is, one of the things was to reduce the so-called oversupply. But yet what really happens in the real world is, as you said, there are some people who may live in an outlying county. They may have to drive miles upon miles to try to actually access a service. It seems like that because that's the reality of it, that you would have state lawmakers who would say, wait a second, maybe we're off track here with this con law.
Right. So the intent is to bring down costs by limiting the supply. The thought is that if you reduce the amount of unused equipment or unused beds, then it would bring down overhead costs across the board. But when you limit the supply, you really limit the competition and the options that consumers have. And these incumbent providers can use this market power to really charge whatever rates they want and to really just dictate who can come in and compete with them to get access to the same patient population.
And talk about real world impact, not only on patients, but Recently here at the John Locke Foundation, we hosted a Forsyth County doctor who is in the process of trying to fight this certificate of need law as it relates to his practice, and he's trying to be able to offer MRI services to his patients. Give us kind of the Reader's Digest version of what his issue is and how it's impacting his patients.
Right. So the case you're referring to is Dr. Singh, and he opened an imaging center in Forsyth County, and he was able to acquire most of the equipment to provide all the services he wanted to, except an MRI machine. The state regulates MRI machine usage, and Forsyth County hospitals had all the certificate of needs for this. So he applied to the state to say that he wanted to offer lower rates to patients in Forsyth County, and the state said no, there is no need for this, even though the patients, as Dr. Singh will tell you, there's plenty of them coming up to him saying that we can't afford the MRI and other imaging services that hospitals are charging, and we need these services done. So Dr. Singh went out, tried to provide this service, and the state simply said no, there's no need for this.
This is so curious that someone sitting in Raleigh, and no disrespect meant to people who are doing their job as part of a state agency, they're following the rules that are in place and the law that's in place, but it just seems really quizzical that they would think that they could actually assess the so-called need when you've got a doctor right there who's
right.
saying, my patients need this service and I want to offer it. Why won't you let me do that?
Right. So, you know, it really is quite something to think about that the state planning boards in Raleigh think that they know the needs of the patients at community level better. And so I just think that that's not the way that this type of regulation should go forward and what it should do.
We've been talking with Jordan Roberts. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's written a really fascinating piece about this law we've been discussing. It's called the North Carolina Certificate of Need Law. Jordan, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org. Or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.